que yo le digo se sienten en carne propia, que en tierra venezolana el imperialismo yanqui hace lo que les da la gana.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontline, segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Manuel Criollo, and I'll be your host for today. Today we'll spend, you know, a good chunk of the show with Eva Golinger, a Venezuelan-American attorney and author, who since 2003 has been investigating, analyzing, and writing about U.S. intervention in Venezuela and the U.S. government's effort to destabilize Hugo Chavez's presidency. She's author of two very important books, The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and her latest book called Bush vs. Chavez. This Thursday, Eva will be in Los Angeles. The Strategy Center is going to host her in an event that we're calling Venezuela and the Responsibility of the U.S. Left. Be a report back from myself and Eric Mann with Eva Golinger, and she's going to have copies of this Chavez Code, so please join us for this important event. It's going to be at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. It's 3300 Wilshire Boulevard, and it's at Wilshire and Barrendo, two blocks west of Vermont. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Eva Golinger. So I'd like to welcome Eva Golinger. Eva is the author of The Chavez Code and Bush vs. Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela, which was published in 2006. Since 2003, Eva has been investigating, analyzing, and writing about U.S. intervention in Venezuela using the Freedom of Information Act. Welcome to the show, Eva.
Thank you very much, Manuel.
So, Eva, you know, I had to do a crash course of both books in some ways, and we, you know, being a host of the radio while at the same time being a full-time organizer is not always the easiest thing. But, you know, one of the things that I got from the books was, or maybe got me curious, was how did life bring you into being this kind of investigator of basically the crimes of the U.S. empire and protecting the sovereignty of Venezuela? What in life brought you to that moment to write these two important books?
Well, basically, as a Venezuelan American, I felt pretty much the responsibility, and as an attorney as well, as an attorney from New York, to find out what one of my governments had been doing to one of my other governments. I mean, initially the investigation began after the coup d'etat against President Chavez in April 2002. And of course, I've always, I mean, for many years, dating back even pre-university studies, I've always had an interest and focus on the topic of U.S. interventions, particularly in Latin America, how the CIA and other intelligence agencies of the United States primarily have functioned around the world, penetrating civil society and imposing an agenda that is generally not received or wanted by the majority of people in those nations. So, you know, when the coup takes place in Venezuela in 2002, obviously everyone thought, well, of course the U.S. government has a hand in this. At the same time, there was a complete lack of any evidence. And as a lawyer, I thought, well, you know, I want evidence to show what this U.S. government is doing. And in the case of Venezuela, and also, you know, the failed coup, I mean, a coup that lasted just that brief sort of 48-hour period. So it seemed as though, you know, we had a sort of an opening into finding out really what had happened, especially because as the coup takes place, it was very public what was going on. The coup leaders were very much proud of what they had done, of their initiative and the success of it at that moment in time, and pretty much displayed on television in Venezuela the way that they had gone about preparing and executing the coup. So there was already sort of a lot of information regarding, on the Venezuelan side, who was involved, what they had done, you know, what the motives were. So basically I felt, as I said before, the responsibility as a U.S. citizen, as a lawyer, as a Venezuelan citizen, to try to find whatever information possible that would clearly demonstrate that the U.S. government had a role in the coup, not knowing really what that would be. And the idea came out about to use the Freedom of Information Act for those purposes, not to wait 20 years until documents are declassified or until allegedly, as most people believe, under the Freedom of Information Act, they would become, you know, available in terms of doing FOIA requests to obtain the documents, but to try right then and there, just a year after the coup, and see what we could get. And the results were absolutely extraordinary. Unknown, you know, to me at the time, that the level of intervention would be so overwhelming. And so basically, as documents began to sort of pour in from more than 500 requests that we submitted, it became apparent that the intervention of the U.S. government in Venezuela was not limited just to the coup, but rather it was an ongoing systematic type of interference, meddling in Venezuelan affairs that was unacceptable and a violation of the sovereignty of the country and of the will of the people. And as an international lawyer, I mean, that was my specialty, was particularly international human rights, I still have an idealistic view of how the world community could function under a legitimate and respectful type of system of international law, and believe that, you know, these are what the U.S. government is doing in Venezuela is a clear violation of any principles of international law, and therefore must be denounced, and you know, with that must be stopped. And eventually, I mean, the information was just so immense that, and my dedication and commitment to the investigation, and not just the investigation in itself, but really a larger commitment to social justice, that it completely consumed my life in the sense that I left a law practice that I had in New York and moved to Venezuela, to Caracas, and now this is what I do full time, is this investigation, writing the books, not just using Freedom of Information Act, but still doing that, but now actually that whole process and the information uncovered in the publication of my first book, of the Chavez Code, has opened the doors to just an enormous wealth of information that now I get from all kinds of sources around the world. And also sort of inspired others to pursue this type of, at least, methodology or the investigation in the sense of finding out information and then denouncing and making it public immediately, not waiting in a sort of academic way until I get sufficient enough information to present a scholarly type case, or being selfish about the information, keeping it all just for me until someday I want to make a big explosion, but rather sharing the information on a regular basis. Also take away some of the myth and the taboo of talking about what the U.S. government is doing in foreign nations, what the CIA does, how it functions, you know, how the Pentagon intelligence, Defense Intelligence Agency operates. I mean, to really get all that stuff out there so that people are aware of these things happening around them. And I can tell you that in the case of Venezuela, I mean, this work has really opened the eyes of so many Venezuelans and made them, everybody in the country really, so much more astute and aware and conscious of the way these strategies function, so that less now people are saying, oh, the CIA did that, or it's the U.S. government hands, so really people can point out and talk about, this is the way it functions, this is how it's happening, I see it in my communities, you know, we're doing something about it. And, I mean, it's helped to increase the level of intelligence, defense, security in Venezuela, not just from the state, but also, you know, amongst the people, to put up more obstacles to the U.S. efforts to destabilize. And so far, been successful. I mean, the U.S. has now been going at it. You know, I have a second book, The Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War in Venezuela. It's not because I wanted to publish it. It's because after I wrote the Chavez Code in 2004, the intervention continued.
Right, or as I read in the book, you were saying...
able to sort of stop, at least they haven't been able to overthrow the government again.
Right. Well, like you were saying in the book, in the Chavez Code, at the time that you wrote it, you also didn't want to really make massive conclusions, given that information was coming in and out on a constant basis, and you wanted to be at least, you know, give the time to sit with just the information you were present and give it to the people. It's interesting that I think, you know, in many ways, I guess I really am interested in the process of how you got this information and also how you felt. You know, I would say that as young people, myself, I include myself still as a very young person, that sometimes when we join the left, it's not always clear to us what the task for us is. And I'm assuming going through the Freedom of Information Act, going through scrounges of mail and faxes, must not be all of the most romantic conversation, you know, sort of work, but it seems to be the very necessary work. How did you process that work, and what made you keep that commitment? Because it could have been overwhelming. I'm assuming you had thousands and thousands of pieces of paper on how to sort of put this puzzle together.
Yeah, it is. I have, at this point, probably close to 10,000 different pieces of paper, documents. In a strange way, I actually love declassified documents. I love research. I love reading the documents, really, and analyzing them, you know, reading them over and over again, because each time you read them, you find out more things. But absolutely, I mean, a lot of people, especially because my work has become so public in Venezuela and some places, other places around the world, and with the books and everything, and obviously, you know, I have a close relationship with President Chavez and others in the government and in the revolution. And so a lot of people see, and I have a radio program on TV, all kinds of stuff, columnists, that as a result of what this, you know, work has produced. So a lot of people see this sort of glamorous side of it and think, oh, well, you publish books and you travel the world and you're on TV. But in reality, it's actually incredibly tedious and meticulous work, and just hours upon hours upon hours of reading documents and analyzing them, writing about them, you know, and trying to figure them out. And I mean, literally, especially when I was doing the Chavez Code and writing the Chavez Code, I felt like I left with, and actually I really did. I mean, that's even probably stranger, but I fall asleep reading the documents. There's documents all over my bed. I mean, I was sleeping with declassified documents, basically. And yeah, I mean, the level of commitment again is the dedication that I feel still to the, you know, the uncovering of this information as part of a larger sort of component of the struggle against imperialism and for social justice, and seeing as how this information is not just about Venezuela. I mean, my information is about Venezuela particularly, but what it demonstrates is a larger sort of scheme that the U.S. government uses, a strategy of intervention that it uses in some cases as a cookie-cutter model of undermining democracies or governments or peoples that don't, you know, favor U.S. interests around the world. So it's really about, you know, diagnosing the information, digesting it, and trying to get it back out there to the public in a more sort of simplistic way, because, again, right, the information is so overwhelming. There's so much of it. And in the end, that's why I decided to write the Chavez Code, because initially I was just making the information public all the time and talking about financing schemes and State Department cables and CIA documents and defense intelligence reports. And it was too confusing. There's too much of it, and it was just way too confusing. So I thought, well, if I can just find a way to sort of contextualize it and make it make sense and put it into a book as a first sort of report on the investigation and the information, it'll make it easier for massive consumption. And it worked. I mean, Chavez Code has, at least in Spanish, there's know, rounds of four editions of publications already, more than 150,000 copies, and it keeps coming out. It's in five languages. And it's because it's a pretty simple read and gives you a lot of information about how, you know, what the U.S. government did in Venezuela, but how it functions overall, and provides documents. I mean, there's like 100 pages of some, you know, the declassified documents, a small portion of them, but still to sort of give the reader a glimpse at what the documents look like and how to read and analyze them, or at least how I did it, and how so far it's been successful in the sense that it has been accurate, that the analysis has been accurate of what the U.S. government is pursuing in Venezuela. And, I mean, again, I think that, you know, in addition to reading the documents, obviously it's obtaining them, so it's an incredibly lengthy process. I mean, this investigation began in 2003, so it's already been 4 years, and I have court cases. I have over 500 appeals of documents from, you know, different agencies that have denied them or censored them or, you know, released in part certain documents. And, I mean, it'll go on, I'm sure, for decades more, because types of things can eventually take a long time. But it's really about patience,
right,
and, you know, being willing to sit and read a lot.
Yeah, no, you know, I said that because, you know, in the work that we do, there's one particular aspect of inside our Bus Riders Union campaign was that it became a struggle for data in some ways. And the struggle, you had to sort of go through tons of information around the direct violations of people who were standing up on a bus. And for a lot of people, they might not find that as, hey, you know, it's not going out in the street. But for us, it was a very important tool. And I think it's just an important sort of lesson about, you know, what commitment can take us to. And it's going to have different formats or anything, but I guess I wanted to get into the nature of the book. One of the things that I saw is that you were talking about sort of the lessons of Chile and Nicaragua, and in particularly the growth of, at least in the Nicaragua, you know, which seems in some ways what some of the models that they're attempting to build in Venezuela through the National Endowment for Democracy and U.S. aid. In your view, What are these bodies, in fact, doing inside Venezuela, and why have they not been as successful as we could see in Nicaragua? Even though in the book, as you clearly state, in Nicaragua, it was not an overnight, you know, sort of victory. It took almost 10, 12 years to undermine the sovereign government of Sandinistas at that point.
Absolutely. I mean, the models, basically, you know, I was giving a conference today, currently in Ann Arbor in Michigan. I was giving a conference at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and somebody asked, well, what's new in the case of Venezuela if all these strategies have been used before? Hey, we've heard this whole story, blah, blah, blah. The U.S. government's been pursuing these types of efforts in Latin America now for decades, which is true. But in the case of Venezuela, it's like a giant melting pot of U.S. intervention strategies. I mean, the Chile model is applied with the strikes and the coup. You know, the Nicaragua model with the financing through the National Endowment for Democracy and then the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, you know, pouring money into building up opposition coalitions, giving them even the same name that they gave them in Nicaragua, you know, the Democratic Coordinator, and then, bringing together all these different political parties and NGOs and private media and labor unions and business associations and trying through semi-electoral means or pressures through strikes, that type of stuff to overthrow the government. And, I mean, all this stuff is in here. Even, you know, I was saying now we're up to the point where we've also got, in many ways, the Cuba model better worded, the Fidel strategy, which is the assassination, trying assassination attempts, or, you know, Salvador Allende or others. The list is practically endless. And, I mean, we have that now in the case of Venezuela and many assassination attempts out there against President Chavez. So, and obvious economic sabotage, trying to cripple the economy, disinformation, psychological warfare. Now what we call actually in my new book, in Bush versus Chavez, more sort of clear that what we're engaging in is this new terminology that's being used not just, you know, in military circles, but beyond that, in the case of Venezuela, absolutely, is what's called asymmetric warfare, which is basically everything, all those strategies thrown together, everything you can get, everything you can use to try to undermine your enemy. And it's very clear, and in asymmetric obviously refers to the fact that it's unequal enemies, which is true in the case of Venezuela. Venezuela doesn't have military power that, compared to the U.S. The U.S. obviously could go in and invade if that's what they wanted to do, and, you know, they've threatened to do that. There are inklings of that they could do it if they want to do it, building up military presence around Venezuela, threatening that in subtle ways. But that's not so far what they've pursued. They're pursuing everything else. And, I mean, why has it failed in the case of Venezuela? Well, one, initially, I believe it was more because the U.S. government put too much confidence into the power, the organization, and the possibilities that the opposition had. You know, the opposition in Venezuela, the opposition of Chavez, primarily is a middle to upper class elite community of people that held power before Chavez, whether it be that they were members of political parties that governed or multinational or corporate interests, economic interests that basically ruled the country before Chavez. So these are the people, because before the Chavez administration, Venezuelan governments had great relationships with the U.S. It was just basically an open door for the U.S. to come in and do whatever they want. Even though the oil industry was nationalized in 1976, it still functioned as a private corporation and gave preference to U.S. oil companies and U.S. interests, and the same for almost everything else in terms of industry in Venezuela. So these are the current members of the opposition or leaders of the opposition, the ones that always had relationships with the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So I believe that in the first couple of years of the Chavez administration and of the revolution, there was the confidence, the information sources, and I know this from some of the documents, from a lot of the documents, the primary sources of information intelligence came out of opposition circles. So basically the U.S. government was getting bogus intelligence, and they thought that, okay, well, this opposition is a majority and they're capable of, through a coup or later when that fails, through an economic sabotage and strike, or later when that fails, through a recall referendum, which legitimate under the Constitution, was still heavily financed with U.S. dollars, taxpayer dollars, actually. And all of this failed. The information was wrong. It was inaccurate. Chavez has a majority of support. And there was a complete underestimating of not just the support Chavez had, but the will of the Venezuelan people, and primarily poorer people. I mean, in some ways, it's a very sort of classist, elitist, racist attitude that the U.S. government, or the power structure of the U.S. had, along with its Venezuelan counterparts, thinking, oh, well, these people and these poorer people, poorer, browner people in Venezuela are incapable of resisting, you know, our powerful efforts. Mm-hmm. And it's been wrong all along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think now we're in the power dynamic has been altered dramatically. After the coup, I mean, it's really when the revolution starts to strengthen. Now, you know, we're on a 5-year anniversary coming up on April 11th. So it's been 5 years. Mm-hmm. Venezuela is a totally different nation. I mean, it's the people are much more powerful, more organized, more sophisticated in their political consciousness, every level, in every barrio, every community. And, I mean, now, you know, the U.S. government policies tend to fail because there's still that view, that dominant, you know, elitist attitude that the U.S. has with every country in South America and most around the world, not just so-called developing nations, but that the U.S. is superior, the U.S. knows how to do it, this is the model that should be imposed, and we're the best country in the world or whatever, and so we're going to win. In the case of Venezuela, that hasn't been the reality. And so I think that again, we're looking at sort of a new scenario in the world community, and in the, you know, sort of the structure of how countries are interacting, that Venezuela has now become a regional power, mm-hmm. and leader in a new type of social, economic, and political system that based more on an equitable and more harmonious, more socialist-oriented government, but also functioning within a market economy, but a market economy or an international sort of trade type of scenario that's not exploitative, that's actually cooperative, that's actually integrated and looks for mutual benefit, not for an exploitation or like a type of capitalist model that the U.S. tries to pursue through its free trade agreements. And that's been more well received around the world. So the power dynamic has changed, and the U.S. government hasn't adapted, been able to, because I don't think it understands it fully enough, been able to adapt its strategies of intervention to the new dynamic, and therefore keeps failing in every effort that it pursues.
I want to go into a break, and we'll be back with that, because I do want to get into a conversation about, obviously, on the international scene, the overextension of the U.S. being in Afghanistan and Iraq have really, obviously, not fostered it, but definitely have aided the call for integration and the rejection of neoliberalism in Latin America. And obviously, I also want to get into what are your thoughts about one moment, for better or for worse, the movements in support of El Salvador and Nicaragua in particular in the 80s were so much powerful than at this moment. And I partly know that it's partly some of the disorientation of the left here in the U.S. We've been talking to Eva Gollinger. She's the author of The Chavez Code and Bush vs. Chavez, which is her latest book. It's Bush vs. Chavez, The War on Venezuela. So we'll be right back, and we'll have Eva give us some of these answers on some of these questions. So stay tuned.